Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Some said the killer couldn't be a local. Others claimed he was the wealthy son of a prominent Morgantown family. Whispers spread that Merritt and Karen were sacrificed by a satanic cult or had been victims of a madman poised to strike again. Then the handwritten letters began to arrive. You will locate the bodies of the girls covered over with brush. Look carefully. The animals are now on the move. Investigators didn't find too few suspects. They had far too many. There was the campus janitor with a fur fetish, the harmless delivery man who beat a woman nearly to death, the nursing home orderly with the bloody broomstick, and the bouncer with the girlish laugh who threatened to cut off people's heads. Local authors Jeffrey C. Fuller and S. James McLaughlin tell the complete story of the murders for the first time. The book that we're featuring this evening is the WVU Co-Ed Murders, Who Killed Merritt and Karen, with my special guest journalists, Jeff Fuller and S. James McLaughlin. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Jeff Fuller and S. James McLaughlin.
Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Good evening. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Let me start off with you, Sarah. I won't ask how you became involved with this story, because that is involved in our interview and occurs later in this story. But why don't I get you, Sarah, to tell us a little bit of the background about Merritt Ellen Malerick and Karen Farrell, and get us a little bit of the setting for where this incredible story occurs.
Sure. Merritt and Karen had met at WVU. They were both freshmen. Karen was from a little town called Quinwood in West Virginia, and Merritt was from Smoke Rise, New Jersey, which was sort of an upper-class area. And they became really fast friends, and it wasn't really their typical behavior to hitchhike, but with the way that the transportation was set up at WVU, West Virginia University, they lived really far out in a dorm called Beverly Manor. They lived in the Westchester Hall of Beverly Manor. And the buses would stop running at, I think it was 7 p.m., something like that, on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they had gone to see a movie together. And the movie didn't let out until after 10:30 at night. So they had the option to either walk back to their dorms. This was January 18th, 1970. It was freezing cold. It was snowing. There was probably ice. And a lot of their trip, because this is West Virginia, a lot of that was going to be uphill on the way back. Mm-hmm. So they opted to hitchhike. And they were last seen getting into a cream-colored car and they disappeared. The local police considered them runaways and didn't really look into the case very much until the state police stepped in. And then that's when it became an actual missing persons case. And I can go further if you want. That's sort of how they are part of this story, how they met, and why they were important to this story.
You talked about Morgantown police being involved till the state police intervened here. Jeff, tell us about what Morgantown police do, what information did they find. These women have disappeared, so how do they proceed?
Well, they issued, they contacted the state police and the FBI, kind of standard procedure, and said that they're missing. They had, over some time, the subsequent couple weeks after they disappeared, they had tips coming in from different places, and they would follow up on those specific tips. But our biggest problem, sirs, and my problem in writing the book was the records from the Morgantown police are long gone. So we only had news accounts and interviews and things like that, which, you know, gave us a picture of what was happening, but not definitive picture. And so it appears that they largely decided that, as Sarah said, the girls ran away, and they didn't know where to look. So they didn't actually do that much, apparently, other than follow up on tips that came in.
Now tell us about the state police. When do they get involved, and who from the state police gets involved?
Well, they were already in town because there was the county prosecutor had gotten in his car on January 2nd, and the car had exploded when he turned the ignition key. So there were state police and probably some FBI people, and there was the brand new ATF was also in town. But they were, looking into how did that crime happen, what happened, who may have been responsible. And in the process, they begin to hear rumors of a connection between the disappearance and the bombing. And those rumors probably, they weren't, as it turned out, really based on anything, but they probably arose because West Virginia, at the time especially, was fairly, appeared to be at least fairly low crime. I mean, Sarah and I found out later we weren't as low crime safe as we thought. But anyway, the general perception was that there was no crime, and and then these two big crimes happened within a couple of weeks of each other, and everyone sort of, or a lot of people started thinking, well, they must be connected. So the state police went to the Westchester Hall to interview anyone, who lived on the fourth floor of Westchester Hall where Merritt and Karen lived, and see if they could find a connection between the two. They didn't, this was in late March by this time, they didn't find the connection that they hoped to find, but they did get very drawn into the case because they didn't realize that it had been so severe and that these two people had been missing without a trace for 3 months.
So as you say, Sarah, as Jeff has said, the emphasis was on the Lurita case with the sensational explosion and trying to kill this prosecutor potentially. But what it did have as an effect was that the story of Merritt and Karen now got a lot of traction in the media, didn't it?
Yeah, this wasn't the only reason that their case got attention, but it's sad that it had to come from other places. So we have Lurita's bombing, and that's what brings in the state police, who are actually investigating it as a missing person and not a runaway. But then we have these mysterious letters that are postmarked from Cumberland, Maryland, that are taunting the whereabouts of these young women. And so the state police are sort of galvanized at that point through the governor to try and find these women, because the assumption is at this point that whoever's writing these letters that are only signed with a triangle, they're suspect number one at this point.
So how do they proceed with the investigation of these triangle letters? What does it lead to?
Well, in the second letter, there is a crudely drawn map, and it has directions that you go 25 miles south from the most southern tip of Morgantown, and then 1 mile into the woods. And the police took that seriously. They got in their cars, and they drove, and they went 25 miles, and then they went one more, and they found themselves in downtown Grafton. And they were not in the middle of the woods. They were in the middle of a fairly large city. But it was around this time that there were also some items of the girls that were being collected in the searches from the National Guard. And so a lot of the roads that lead south from Morgantown were being searched, and they were finding their licenses, broken compacts. They found prescription pills and prescription glasses, things like that. So they finally got on the trail of where they had been, or at least where their killer had been.
Now, at the same or around this time as well, they find a couple witnesses, this person named Itzy from school and her boyfriend Skip. What do those two people tell state police?
Do you want to take that, Jeff?
Yeah, okay. Itzy was also on the fourth floor at Westchester Hall and sort of heard the commotion. There were a lot of the people waiting up to see the night that they disappeared, waiting up to see if they would come back. And she came out of her dorm room and asked what was going on. And they said, "Oh, you haven't heard, Meredith and Karen are missing." And she said, "Well, I just saw them at a movie. Skip and I were at a movie at downtown at the Metropolitan Theater, and Skip and Itzy had decided to take the bus rather than hitchhike, so they split off from the girls, and the girls started hitchhiking." And so Skip and Itzy had seen the two of them, a car stopped for them, a small white car, apparently a Cadillac or Chevy, or they weren't sure. And they had gotten into that car, and the car had driven past them and disappeared into the night. Now, when the car went past them, Barrett and Karen did not even acknowledge Skip and Itzy. Now, maybe they were talking and not paying attention, or maybe they weren't able to acknowledge because they had been told to not to. So that's unclear. But they essentially were, from that point, looking for a white car, either Cadillac or Chevy, and Chevy was the leading contender, driven by a young man, dark hair, and the descriptions were variously, the descriptions were variously between somewhere between 25 and 40. They weren't sure of the age of the man, but he was very clean cut and also didn't signal them or anything, didn't acknowledge them.
And this car was like a white or a cream-colored car, but it had fins on the back.
Now, Sarah, there was another person that came forward, Donna DeYoung, and it's important regarding the petition that she initiates or wants to initiate. Tell us about Donna DeYoung, what she says to police.
Donna had been friends with Merritt. They had gone to school in New Jersey, I think from grade school through graduation, and they were actually roommates in college. She was Merritt's roommate, and she was very, very concerned when they went missing. She said that wasn't like Merritt at all, and she contributed quite a bit to try and help them find the girls. She and Merritt actually had matching purses, and so she sent her purse into the police so that they would know exactly what they were looking for. And she claimed that she got a strange phone call from a man with a strange accent, and he was telling her what she needed to get the police to do in order to find these girls. And we're not sure exactly if that was someone who had been law enforcement or if this was someone that was just trying to help and thought this was the best way. But she tried to take this to the police. They weren't sure whether or not to take her seriously or not. And when she wasn't getting the answers that she wanted or she wasn't getting the reaction that she wanted, she and a handful of other students that were concerned went to the university president, and he helped get them an audience with the governor. And with that petition, they were able to talk to the governor and try to get a little more coverage on this case and get a little more manpower behind it.
A little aside here, just that we keep referring to Merritt and Karen as girls, and there are a couple reasons for that. One is that the age majority at the time was 21, so they technically were underage. And also, that's how women were referred to, women of that age were referred to at the time. So, we're not trying to be disrespectful or anything. Nowadays, you'd say it was two young women, but anyway, I just wanted to clarify that.
So police are also, there's an event on February 17th where a couple young women, Candy Bales and Cindy Smith, what happens with this and what do police believe might be this crime's relation to Karen and Merritt?
Candy and Cindy had also been hitchhiking. They had been right across from the mountain lair, a little strip in between the lanes called Grumbine Island, and they were picked up by two young men in a red GTO. And they were asking them to drop them off at their dorms, but the men kept going towards Star City and Osage, which was the opposite direction in which they needed to go. And they were driving really recklessly. They were driving fast. They were skipping red lights. And they were ignoring the girls when they're saying, hey, I need to get back. I told my boyfriend I would be there. The girls are really scared because they're being ignored. They're not sure where they're being taken. And they notice there's a crate of soda bottles, glass soda bottles in the back seat. So Candy grabs one and hides it in her jacket. And when the two men finally stop and get out, she grabs Cindy and pulls her out of the car. And they try to make a run for it, and one of the men tries to grab her, and he grabs Candy by the throat, and so she hits him in the head with his bottle, and she breaks the bottle on him, and he finally lets her go. And they're able to kind of hide from them and walk down along the street. They're in Osage at this point, and they're able to hide behind some cars along the road until they feel that it's safe. And then they hitchhike again to get back into Morgantown. Perfect. And they didn't really want to tell anyone because Candy was afraid that she would go to jail for assault. And the other girls in her dorm were like, hey, if you don't tell the police about this, this could happen to someone else. And so that's when she decides that she is going to figure out who this man is. And she does a lot of legwork. She does some detective work to find out who this person is, because when she calls the police, they don't give her much of a reaction. So she knows if she has his name, she can bring forth a stronger case. And she remembered seeing his name, I think on his shirt, like his first name. And she knew that the bottles in the back were from RC Cola. And so she took a chance that he worked at that warehouse. And she called all of the numbers that she could find, and then the number that she got from the warehouse when she called and asked for his first name until she finally found him. And then she took that information to the police, but not until after she stalked him so that she could see his face and make sure that it was him. And she said he saw her and he was quite shook.
Yeah.
Another little scene setting thing here. We're talking about hitchhiking a lot, and that seems very strange to a lot of people nowadays. But at the time, West Virginia had a split campus. Well, it still does now, but transportation's better. They had a split campus, which was about a mile apart. And what that meant was that a lot of students hitchhiked constantly. So down on Grumbine's Island, right in front of the Student Union, there would be dozens and dozens of people hitchhiking. So hitchhiking was not sort of two individuals or four individuals taking a chance. It was a common method of transportation at the time. And a car would stop, and as many students as could fit would pile into the car, and it would drive away. So that was very common.
Tell us about Troopers Gooden and Mitchell, and also their Sergeant Heiss, and just the character of Gooden and some of the ideas he had regarding this murder, or these murders.
Yeah, well, Preston Gooden was one of the state troopers who had a lot of experience coming into the state police, and he'd taken lots of courses. He had trained with various police institutions, and one of the things he was especially good at was investigation. That's what his background was in. Mitchell was a sergeant. He was kind of in charge, but actually much of the investigation, Harold, a man named Larry Harold, was also a trooper, and Preston Gooden were together. Now, Preston Gooden was very careful, did things by the book, and he became very concerned about what might have happened to the two girls, Mary and Karen, but also at the frequency with which similar things were happening, like with Cindy and Candy. That kind of thing seemed to happen a lot. We've got some of that in the book, their interviews with people in Westchester, and they kept going back and back to Westchester. They would scour the streets looking for a similar car. They would, they did a lot of that kind of thing, trying to follow up everything, and they spent long hours at that. Until at one point on April 16th, at about 11 in the morning, they started hearing some of the radio traffic and realized the girls had been found about 10 miles south of Morgantown.
Tell us the state that the police find the bodies of Merritt and Karen, and what do they derive evidence-wise as a result?
The bodies were found under a really crudely constructed tomb. That's what the media called it. It wasn't necessarily a tomb. It was very large rocks and a forked tree and branches, lots of brush that were covering them. And as they were dissecting this and pulling everything off, they realized that the girls were missing. Karen was missing one of her shoes. Merritt was missing both of her boots, and Karen was missing a coat, but both of them did not have their heads. And those were not found on any of the land. It wasn't found ever to this day.
Yeah, and they had that land area, there were a lot of mines, and so they were searching the mines and so forth. They looked all over the place, drain ponds, and couldn't find anything.
What was there any indication of sexual assault or any kind of sexual contact?
There wasn't really a good way to test it. They had been in the weather for 88 days. Karen was sort of on the top, and she had taken the most damage from the elements and from animals. So they weren't able to ascertain whether that was or was not. There wasn't enough to test to find any evidence either way. But the way that they were found fully clothed, Merritt was still wearing her stockings, and she had a cigarette pack that she had tucked in the waistband with one cigarette. So it seemed really unlikely that they had been assaulted and then dressed themselves back so carefully.
So what happens in terms of suspects emerging?
Well, the first suspect they had was a man named Thrasher who lived nearby. They had been canvassing the neighborhood. They, being Harold and Gooden, had been canvassing the neighborhood, and they stopped by Lloyd and Thelma's Vilma's place and a farm, and they found out that there was a young man who named Eddie, or Charles Edward, but he was they called him Eddie, and he was had been a janitor at Westchester Hall, and he became the first person they looked into as a suspect. Now, subsequently, there were many suspects. We have the whole section of the book that deals with the various people who were doing different kinds of bad things or had drawn the attention of authorities for various reasons that they thought might have been Merritt and Karen, or might have been the killers of Merritt and Karen.
Well, and we also right. still had the letter writers at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the things the police did was, the state police did, was take handwriting samples of everybody they talked to, whether they were suspects or not, but they wanted to compare those handwriting samples to the letters.
You talk about
Eddie. A lot.
Go ahead, sorry.
There was actually a good bit of police work that went into tracking down the letter writer. I mean, thousands and thousands of handwriting samples taken, checked from voter registration, and they were actually able to track the letter writers to a psychic science church in both Somerset, PA, and Cumberland, Maryland, with several members. They were able to track them down, and they found out that the person that was writing them was a Reverend Hoover, and he was doing a seance and talking to a Dr. Spencer, who was telling him how to find the bodies. And they were eventually cleared. They were found to have nothing to do with the crimes.
Dr. Spencer, by the way, was he had died, I'm not sure when that was, I think the 1800s. He was a disembodied spirit that Reverend Hoover was communicating with.
There was a dentist, Elias Costianz, he was a suspect for a little while. Why was this dentist a suspect?
Well, Donna, the roommate that we spoke of before, fielded a call about 11 o'clock Monday morning after the girls disappeared on Sunday night. And the call came from a dentist, Elias Costianz, who is, you know, fairly prominent local dentist, and he had fixed Merritt's. Merritt had had an appointment with him the previous Monday, and he had started working on a root canal kind of procedure, and she was supposed to show up at his office that Monday at 11. Now, police thought it was odd at the time that why would a dentist call the dorm to try and figure out where the patient was? You know, it just seemed odd, and they kind of thought it might be alibying behavior, you know, that he was like, I'm not guilty, I called. And so they did talk to him at the time. They didn't really investigate much at all. Somebody had a talk with him and ruled it out, but there wasn't any strong reason to rule him out or in at the time.
He was also seen on campus with a white Cadillac picking up hitchhiking co-eds.
Mm-hmm. Now, we get back to this Sergeant Heiss, and he believes that the case is linked inextricably to these triangle letters. And so in this particular case, because of that, you have Troopers Gooden and Mitchell and others disagreeing with him. What does this lead to in terms of profiling and sort of the direction of the case and suspects?
Well, I think that some people did agree that there was a ritualistic aspect to it since their heads were missing, but there wasn't a single person who would ever go on record outside of Heiss that said that they saw triangles as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he, Detective Heiss, kind of early on had decided that the two had run away, and he wasn't really, but he's the one that saw various kinds of mystical connections and triangles on the grave and so on and so forth, but no one else seems to have seen that stuff, or at least won't say they did.
I mean, so far as to say in the press that they didn't know what he was talking about.
Well,
yeah.
How does William Gerken become a suspect, and why?
I'll let you take that one, Jeff.
That's Jerkin, by the way. He was a kind of high flying student at WVU. He was in aerospace engineering, but then he started having some issues, some personal issues, and was hospitalized several times. Now, what happened was that there was a rumor floating around among other fraternity guys and kind of around the school that Jerkin had written a story about decapitating two women. In the fall of 1969, he had written that story. Now, everyone who was talked to by police had a different version of the story. In some, Jerkin was the one who was decapitated, or he was the one, killed. It was a knife fight. It was gun. I mean, it was just various different versions of the story, and no one could ever produce the story. So there really wasn't anywhere to go with that. Now, as it turned out, he was having some problems, personal problems, and that just added to the rumor mill.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor, which is Quip. Good health starts with good habits. Quip makes it easy by delivering all the oral care essentials you need to care for your mouth. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million mouths and has timed sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended 2-minute clean. A lightweight and sleek design for adults and kids with no wires or bulky charger to weigh you down. A multi-use travel cover that doubles as a mirror mount for less clutter. Reusable handles in a range of sleek metal hues, including best-selling all black and all pink, as well as bright plastic colors sure to make a pop to your bathroom counter. On top of your brushing, you can upgrade your Quip with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing with the free Quip app. And earn amazing rewards like free refills, products, Target gift cards, and more. Beyond the brush, Quip has everything you need to build a complete routine. Anti-cavity toothpaste that helps prevent cavities. Refillable mouthwash that's a 4 times concentrate, plus good for you and the planet. In addition to brush heads, Quip also delivers fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and gum refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of in-store shopping. With stylish and affordable electric brushes starting at just $25, you won't be paying through the teeth for better oral health. If you can get quip.com/shocking right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/shocking. GETQUIP.com/shocking. Quip, the good habits company. Now, we were talking about what would lead to further suspects, and then we talk about January 1976, and a man confesses to killing and decapitating two college girls. Who is this, and tell us more about this January 1976 confession. Sarah.
I was going to let Jeff have that one. Eugene Paul Clausen was actually an inmate in a New Jersey prison, and he wrote a letter to the West Virginia State Police claiming that he had killed both the girls. And in looking a little bit closer at Clausen, he had had a cellmate that was trying to help him perpetuate this idea that he wasn't able to sleep, that he was haunted by his actions, and that he just couldn't hold it in anymore, and he had to confess. And when he was asked about the crime, about what he did exactly, and he wrote like a I think it was a 44-page statement, and it was just absolutely outlandish. It had all of the markers of several fetishes, and it was not really adding up with the evidence necessarily. And whenever he would be confronted with some of these, he would change his story. He claimed that he kept the heads and he had buried them under the house next to where he grew up. And then he changed that story to he threw them in a crevasse on Conn Hill in Pennsylvania. And so there was a search there. They put cameras into the ground and they found some hairs, human hairs from animal nests. But at that point, they weren't really able to test hair with DNA that didn't have a bulb. And so they were only able to look at this hair underneath a microscope and say, well, this could be one of the girls. It's sort of reddish and dyed. And they thought maybe it might be Merritt's hair because she colored her hair. But he also changed his mind and decided that he hadn't done the crimes, and that to understand Clausen, you have to realize that there was a mental deficit. He was learning disabled. He had Klinefelter syndrome, so he was XXY. There were a lot of, like, the situation was really stacked against him with his physical deformities and just basically that syndrome usually plays a part in impotence really, really highly. And he was claiming that he was raping them several times, and it wasn't really adding up to his physical condition. It wasn't adding up with the evidence. And then he claimed that he made this up because he wanted to be taken from the New Jersey prison to the West Virginia prison, which was closer to where his mother lived. And he thought that once he was found not guilty, because he didn't really do it, that he would be free. And it doesn't quite work like that. He would still have to finish his sentence. So he was a really interesting character. He was a very terrible person, but we don't believe that he's responsible, although he was convicted in 76 and again in 81.
Yes, you write about this. You write about the prosecutor,
also,
David Solomon, being tied to this and wanting and believing that he had the right man. So he pursued this regardless. And when you did, both of you re-examine the evidence and the confession itself, there were numerous contradictions and just... there was just no way that you could corroborate any of the things that he said in that confession. Not true.
Yes,
that's
absolutely true. Yeah, and it wasn't just us. There was a man named George Castell who had been a law clerk at the West Virginia Supreme Court when they were reviewing the first conviction, and he couldn't believe that there had been a conviction, and he reexamined every bit of the case, and he had said that he wanted to, in his draft, you know, results report, he had said he had wanted to dismiss charges against Clausen with prejudice, which means they couldn't even refile. The case was that weak, but the judge, for whatever reason, didn't go along. The main, you know, the head judge of the Supreme Court did not go along with that recommendation, but they did overturn the 76 verdict based on prejudicial evidence that was introduced by Prosecutor Solomon. And so he had to be retried in 1981.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us, Jeff, how you become involved with the state police, Preston Gooden, and others. Tell us about this involvement.
Yeah, I was living in Charleston at the time on the other side of the state, and I was teaching classes, writing classes, and a gentleman who took one of my classes came up to me and asked me if I'd ever heard of the co-ed murders or the investigation or anything, and he turned out to be, he was retired, but he was Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hall when he retired, and he wanted to go back and reinvestigate the case, which is how we both, or how I got back into the case, because I was just sort of shadowing his investigation for a few years, starting in 2006, I believe it was, and he was convinced. He had been sent up to Camden, New Jersey, to take Clausen's initial confession and see if it made sense, because Richard had a lot of training with the Marines and then in the police, with the state police, in investigation, but also in testing confessions and, you know, figuring out what was true. And he came away from that believing that Clausen, that there was no way that Clausen was making it all up. And Richard says every time he would say, well, it was pretty dark up there, how did you see? And then suddenly Clausen would have a flashlight, which he had never mentioned before. So there just kept being elements of the confession that appeared in response to Richard's questions. And he just thought, no, this guy didn't do it. Well, everyone else thought he did do it, and Richard was essentially overruled. And that may have been because of the, what Richard called it, a social verdict, which he said was, it was basically a verdict by society. Society had decided that he was guilty, and he was kind of, the case was ran through without a thorough investigation, which Richard didn't approve of. So that's how I got back into it. He was reinvestigating a number of people.
Now, how does Charlie Heron and Eddie Thrasher get discussed again? And what is their connection via their grandparents, interestingly?
Well, Richard and I had taken a trip to Morgantown. Richard had received some tips, various people who said that they had information, and we came up to Morgantown to talk to some of those people. Now, one of them told us that there was he grew up in the area of the Weirton Mines, the area where the bodies were found, and there was a gentleman there by the name of Charlie Heron. This guy who was telling us this had been sent by us. He used to go to the Heron farm from Lloyd and Vilma to get eggs all the time. But his parents had told him, don't go there when Charlie's there alone, because they were afraid of Charlie, because he was, I guess, scary. He fought a lot, considerably. He also apparently used to set fires in the neighborhood, and this guy told us that Charlie used to torture animals. And I asked him he meant by that, because, you know, that's a large spectrum, torturing animals. Mm. Well, he said that Charlie used to pull the legs off cats. So the point that he said that, Richard and I kind of exchanged glances, because that's pretty significant kinds of torture. And when we left there, you know, we thanked him. When we left there, Richard said, well, let's go see Charlie. So we drove down the hill into Morgantown and talked to Charlie. And Richard, I was essentially a witness or someone standing there. I just stood there in his room, and Richard asked him some questions, and he had at this time a kind of avuncular manner about him when he was talking to people, and, you know, kind of gee shucks kind of thing. And at one point, he asked Charlie if he had any idea who might have done this. And Charlie started rattling off names, which was weird, because we had talked to a lot of other people, and everyone kind of reluctantly would come up with one name. Well, I always wondered about this guy. But Charlie had a whole list of names. And Richard thought that was odd and let it settle. And then a little while later, he said, what kind of car did you drive back then, Charlie? And his whole demeanor changed. He just got really cold. And he said, what do you want to know that for? And Richard said, oh, I'm just nosy, I guess. And Charlie said, that nose of yours is going to get you hurt. We're done. And so that's how Charlie became of interest. Now, it turned out Charlie was the uncle of the first suspect, Eddie Thrasher.
Right.
So they lived at the same place, but the state police back in 1970 had no idea, apparently, that Charlie existed.
Well, let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, with the connection with Eddie Thresher and Charlie Heron, you also investigated the idea of about hacker and research beheadings. What did you find out about hacker and beheadings in the area?
Well, that initially, back around 2008 or 2009, Hacker had on December. Do you want to talk about that, Sarah? How he came?
Sure, I can talk about Hacker.
Yeah. Okay.
Hacker was originally from Brooklyn, New York, but his family migrated into the Monongalia, Marion County area in West Virginia. And when Hacker was very small, he was actually working in the mines, which wasn't super uncommon. But he was around when the Monongah mine disaster happened. And the explosion from that mine explosion, the people that were harmed viciously. I mean, dismemberments. There were a lot of beheadings from the people that were on the surface, and he would have seen that at a very young age. That I'm sure that would have impacted him very greatly. Jeff had done some research into just finding articles along that area where the train would go between mining camps, between West Virginia and Pennsylvania or Ohio, and he had collected probably, 25 different articles where there were men found without heads?
Yeah, and that was between 1920 and 1952, so it was over a long period of time.
And in 1952 is when Hacker was arrested for killing two people in a bar in Fairmont, his girlfriend and a man there who had stood up to him when he was trying to drag her out of the bar and she didn't want to go. He actually left the bar and returned with a gun and he shot them both. And he did some time, but he was let out of prison early because the governor gave him a pardon for his efforts in rescuing miners from another incident. And so when he was out of prison, do you remember the year, Jeff?
Yeah, and he got the pardon in 1966. And also, it's important to know, back then, the state prison where he was being held had its own mining operation. So Hacker was both a prisoner and one of the leaders in the mine when he did this rescue and then got the pardon.
Mm-hmm.
This is fun. Just go ahead.
The decapitations, strangely, when I was researching that, they stopped in 1952. There weren't any more. And then they started back up in 1966. And that corresponded to when, or 1967, and that corresponded to when Hacker was let out of prison. And they continued. There were two or three more. And then Meriden Caron, followed by a man, Herbert Coben, and Hacker was arrested for that decapitation.
Let's talk about the book that you are writing, and at one point you realize that someone else is writing that book, and you want to find out who that is. And you and Sarah eventually meet. Sarah, tell us about this meeting.
I was finally able to get a hold of him. I don't really know how Facebook works. I think it goes into like your junk mail account or something. So it wasn't instant. It took a while. And I wasn't sure if I would ever be able to talk to Jeff about this. But he was very amenable. He said, yeah, let's have some dinner. We'll talk about the case. And so he brought this big old like satchel full of case files. And I realized that we had been talking for 2 hours and that wasn't nearly enough. Like I wasn't going to be able to sit there and listen to everything that he had to say and be able to absorb that. So at this point, he asked me if I want to help him write the book, because in his mind, I was already writing a book.
Mm-hmm. And what else comes of this meeting in terms of the decision other than the book itself?
Well, she piped up that she and another man, Kendall Perkinson, wanted to do a podcast. So we just ended up doing both.
Like, would you consider maybe bringing this to a larger audience and possibly doing a podcast? And I didn't even really listen to podcasts. I knew that some people were interested in them, but I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. I don't care. And then once he found out that I had talked to Jeff, he was like, oh, well, we have to get him to talk to us too. And so I was hoping that Jeff knew what a podcast was as well. And he was amenable to that. So I was like, all right, well, I guess we're going to do a podcast and we're going to do a book. And the podcast went really, really well through word of mouth. We expected it to sort of just kind of stay in the Morgantown area.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this research, with the book, with the podcast, you talk about, Jeff, that one of the people that you were initially involved with, Sergeant Hall, puts a veil up between you. So he thinks he has a different idea who killed Merritt and Karen, and you have a completely different idea. So in your mind and your research with Sarah, who emerges as the likely suspects in their murders and why?
Well, I don't, it's another, I don't know if we want to give that away entirely, but it's another man who hasn't been mentioned so far at all, but he was, and in fact, he was the one that I kind of, he was my leading suspect when Sarah and I first met, and I had been gathering a lot of information about him and his life. He had been arrested in Florida and convicted for kidnapping a woman, holding her captive, and draining her blood, draining and drinking her blood. She had escaped for 3 days, and she had escaped and brought the police. Now, the police, led by a man named Bob Leatherow, who we've talked with extensively, came to believe that this man had killed at least six other women, maybe as many as 25 or 30. But they found pretty good evidence for six that could tie him to six deaths. They never found anything that definitively pinned any of those on him enough to be able to bring charges. But his sister was a freshman at WVU at the time. He had been born in Clarksburg. He grew up till he was about 11, and then his family moved to Upper St. Clair, Pennsylvania, which is about 40 minutes north of here, north of Morgantown. And his sister, like I said, was a freshman at WVU in 1970, the same year that Merritt and Karen were freshmen, and his older brother had graduated from WVU Med School. So there were lots of connections, and we found a lot more circumstantial evidence that he was the one that did it. Sarah is not convinced that he is, we couldn't find anything to definitively say that he had been the one who killed Merritt and Karen.
Dan, I will just say that I'm agnostic at this point. Like, I don't feel that we have anything outside of circumstantial evidence. Jeff makes a strong case, but if we could find that connection that's just irrefutable, then I'll be on Team Jeff.
Charlie Heron and Eddie Thrasher, why were they ruled out?
Yeah, I think Eddie's handwriting didn't match, and that was the reason they were ruled out. But Eddie left town the day before the girls' bodies were found. He moved away from Morgantown, and except for visits, never came back. Charlie left later that summer and moved in with some Amish, with the Amish community in Pennsylvania. So that's suspicious. And Eddie had also, he had been working at Sterling Fawcett on the 17th, 18th, and 19th of January, and he had called in sick on the 18th, the day the girls disappeared, and the 19th, he was not at work.
Interesting. When did the idea for this book start, and when did it complete? When is it released? And just tell us about the status of the podcast.
The book was released in early October, the first week of October, and it's doing pretty well, and we sold out of the first printing, and more is being run.
Jeff, tell us just a little bit about the podcast. Sorry, Sarah.
Okay, well, the podcast had a lot of listens and was received very well. It had, I think, almost all 5-star reviews, and eventually came to the attention of a group in Los Angeles who wanted to do a larger series, which was also part of Sarah and Kendall's plan, because by this time they had done another story, which was set nearby here in Frostburg and Cumberland, and they started a series called Appalachian Mysteria, and apparently been doing very well. But Sarah could address that much more than me.
Let's just let the audience know about where they might be able to take a look at this book and where they could find this podcast.
Okay, well, we have a website called coedmurders.com, coedmurders, all lowercase, .com, and you can find links to both the podcast and, you know, the book, for ordering the book from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the single retailers. And obviously, the podcast you can download or hook up to at any time. And it's basically on every podcast platform.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on, Sarah, James McLaughlin, and Jeff Fuller, the WVU co-ed murders, Who Killed Merritt and Karen. Thank you very much for this interview, and you both have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
You're dedicated to building a bright financial future. Grow your investments with Millibank's high-yield savings account. Earn a highly competitive annual percentage yield with no fees or minimums. Getting started is simple, too. Download the app, link your account, and start growing your money. Welcome to a new way to save more for the things that matter most. Welcome to Millie Bank. Visit millie.bank or download the Millie app today.